Welcome. I know it's a hot afternoon, so thank you. It's actually cooler inside, so it's good for you to be inside. My name is Sharon, and I serve the village as education lead, and it's my utmost pleasure to introduce Chris Sharon. And it's like we share a name, right? But it's not spelled the same. Chris is the Vice President of Applied Research at Auburn Theological Seminary, a long-time Holdenite, former board member, and he will be presenting four times this week and three times next week, and his topic today is the end of a white Christian America. Thank you, Chris, for being here.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thanks for coming this afternoon. I'll start by introducing this series. It's a seven-part series, just saying a little bit about how I got into this project and where I am with it and what I hope we can open up together in conversation. And then I'll dig into the particular topic for this first session, which is based on Robbie Jones' great book, The End of White Christian America. I was just up in the bookstore, and they don't have it, but they're going to order it, and you can get it too. If you get it, make sure you get the paperback version, which has an addendum talking about the implications of the presidential election and sort of how Robbie sees that. So the first thing to say, my bio's on the kiosk, so I won't repeat information that's there, but what I wanted to say in terms of introducing myself is that this story comes out of the intersection of my identity as a white Christian theologian who lives in the United States and my family history connecting with the Laura Ingalls Wilder family. And that, as many of you know, is an iconic, in some ways mythic, story about pioneer settling in the Midwest in the 19th century. And maybe the best-selling children, any children's librarians in the house? One of the best-selling children's series?
Still very popular even 50 years later.
Yeah. So we'll talk more about the stories as we go along. Today isn't so much about the stories, but I just wanted to introduce that fact about me and make the connection for you. So it's really not that uncommon in those days for multiple siblings and two families to marry one another. And the Quiner family and the Ingalls family lived in a small town in Wisconsin east of Milwaukee called Clinton. And each family had a lot of children, and it turned out in the end three siblings from each family married one another. And Charles and Caroline, who are the parents of Laura Ingalls, married each other. They weren't the first to get married, but they got married, and then two other of the sibling pairs got married. And Henry and Polly were my great-great-grandparents. So their daughter, Charlotte, born in 1867, was born in Pepin, Wisconsin, same year as Laura Ingalls Wilder was born, 1867, also in Pepin, Wisconsin. Henry and Polly and Charles and Caroline bought land together. And that was the place where the story, Little House in the Big Woods, took place. And we'll talk about that later on this week. So actually on this trip out, my family drove, and we stopped in Keystone, South Dakota, which is where Henry and Polly ended up. They ended up going farther than to Smet, which is where Laura's family stopped going west, but both in South Dakota, and that's where my grandma May was born. And when she was very young, her parents moved on to Wyoming, which is where my dad grew up. So that family story is a part of my story, and it's a part of an American story. And there are reasons for telling that story right now, engaging that story right now. And I want to say a little bit about In introducing myself and why I'm doing this project, say a little bit about what brought me to the point of saying I should write this book rather than other books. And I say write this book, I'm really just at the beginning of research that will lead to the place of writing this book. And so this week is really an invitation to you to learn with me and to reflect with me about a bunch of material I'm not an expert on, except my family history. I know a little bit about that. But I want to invite you into the conversation about a beloved series of children's stories and complicate them and say for myself, they're actually my white story. So I'm adding a race layer to it. And there's very distinct reasons for that, which I'll talk about. And I want, as a part of the conversation, to invite you to think about your story. If you're white, your white story. If you're not white, the particular story you have as a part of this moment in the world and in the United States. And doing that work, I think, is a part of what it is to be a civic-minded person, more generally, a person concerned about the common good of our country. But also, I think there are reasons to say I didn't hook up my power cord and I may regret it. I have one. I just didn't plug it in because I wasn't thinking it would trip out like that, but I can quickly do it. So the first piece of how I got to deciding I needed to work on this book is a story that I think comes from what happened when Barack Obama was elected president. And it was a watershed moment in our country's history. For many reasons, maybe the most important is the first African American president, but that fact, electing the first African American president, unleashed a range of things that, in a way, you could describe as a resurgence or a reawakening of pretty negative racism in our country, and. It came out in a lot of different ways, and he dealt with it in a complex set of ways, but it was present right in his campaign when his pastor, Jeremiah Wright, at his church in Chicago preached this sermon in which he said, "God damn America." Anyone remember that? Created a big media storm. Obama gave a speech on race in which he addressed it at length. So race was a present in the conversation with his election from the start. And in the years following that, there were some really traumatic national experiences around shooting of young African American men, Trayvon Martin, and then the events in Ferguson with Michael Brown. And in those series of events, the people who shot the young African American men weren't charged, or were charged with something very minor in the few cases where there was a charge. And this unfolded in a way that sort of brought our whole nation into a consciousness about race and especially the circumstances of African Americans, which you could say had been there, but I think there was a new kind of awareness, like what happened with the civil rights when the TV cameras captured it, when they captured what happened in Birmingham, the fire hoses and the billy clubs and so forth. In some of these instances, cell phones captured what was happening, you know, and so when people recorded what was happening on their cell phone and then put it online, all of a sudden all of us were seeing what was happening between police and young African American men in a way that hadn't been as easily accessible. So that story unfolded, and a young man, Philando Castile, was shot when he was pulled over by the police 3 or 4 blocks from our house. And just this summer, the trial concluded and the officer was not charged. And he was a cafeteria worker at a local elementary school and in his early 40s. And he'd been pulled over since he got his driver's license in the neighborhood of 52 times. So just calculate in your head quickly how many times you've been pulled over, or how many times you were pulled over by the time you were 42. So I just did a lot of reflecting myself about the dynamics between white people and people of color in this country because of what was happening in the nation. And I read, many of you might have read this too, Ta-Nehisi Coates' book, Between the World and Me, which is a letter to his son, who was 14 at the time, about race in America. And this is a quote from that book. I have to go like this because it's not. People who believe themselves to be white are obsessed with the politics of personal exoneration. That's from a section where he's talking about, he always uses the phrase, people who believe themselves to be white, because he wants to force us to think about whiteness or being white as a social construction, which is a conversation I'm not going to go into race theory necessarily, but he does that. He draws on James Baldwin before him and a number of other writers who want to push us to think about why do we call ourselves white if we do, if we categorize ourselves as white, why do we do? And he makes this link between the category of whiteness and forgetfulness, because he says there's an intimate relationship between the construction of white identity and violence in America, which is rooted partly in the designation of African Americans as not fully human, therefore enslavable, not just during their life, not just for a period of time, but themselves and their children in perpetuity. So it was a challenge when I read that, and I was thinking, okay, so what does it mean that he's, in a sense, charging me with not knowing my history in order to claim that I'm white? That if I actually knew my history, I would have a harder time saying I'm white, because I would understand the violence that racial identity is built upon. So I took that challenge to heart. And that challenge about knowing my history pushed me to say, well, what is my history? What is my family story? And what if there's violence in my family story, what is that violence? So that's one source of it. Another source of it was we our family moved back to Minnesota from the East in 2008. And so during the first couple of years we were there, there was a buildup to a major historical marker in Minnesota's history, the 150th anniversary of the U.S.-Dakota War, which led to the killing of 5,000-6,000 settlers in southern Minnesota, and the largest mass execution in the history of the United States. 38 Sioux warriors in the end were hung in Mankato on the city square as a part of just a public event. You can see pictures of it. They built gallows and hung them all, signed by President Lincoln, their execution order. And as a part of that, Governor Ramsey issuing a decree that all Dakota should be exterminated or chased from the boundaries of Minnesota. So that historical event was reaching the 150th anniversary. I went to Fort Snelling, which is the fort right in the heart of the Twin Cities at the confluence of the Minnesota and the Mississippi River, which is an important sacred site for the Dakota people. And they built Fort Snelling there, and we toured it, my son and I, and there's no, when we were there, there was no acknowledgement of the Native history at all. So participating in those events, coming up to this anniversary and the real tensions over how do we tell that story as a state? How do we tell the story of this ancient conflict, 150 years old, but still with profound consequences on how we live together in Minnesota now? That led me to engage in again personal reflection. What is my story? What where does the land come from that I'm living on? That my relatives, my ancestors lived on. So I was at an event. I can't remember exactly the event, but I got this book called "What Does Justice Look Like: The Struggle for Liberation in Dakota Homeland," and this is, again, a quote about truth-telling. Truth-telling would disallow Minnesotans from denying or ignoring the history of genocide and the perpetration of human injustices. So this author, Wise Yatawin, says, basically, Minnesotans, especially white Minnesotans, don't want to remember the history because the history is built on genocide. And she uses the UN charter on genocide to make the case about what happened in Minnesota as genocide. So those set of things, of all the things that I, as a scholar and theologian, all of all the things I could write on, this just rose to the top. like in this cultural moment, I felt like I had to engage in truth-telling about my own story. And there's a third reason for it, and that's really the session today, which is in the context of this tension around racism with whites and African Americans, this tension around how we tell the story of our nation and its native peoples, is a third reality that's transpiring right now, which is the demographic transition in our country from white majority to white minority. In fact, I think if you did the statistics with elementary schools, we would already be a majority minority country. And maybe by the predictions are around 2040 or 2050, it's not exactly sure when that's going to happen, the country as a whole will shift from white majority to white minority. That big demographic transition is a complicated reality with lots of implications for how we understand ourselves and how we contribute to the common life that we share in our communities and in our country. So this is a picture in the bottom right of my great-grandma, Charlotte, who's called Lottie in the books. And in fact, she looks so much like my sister. Isn't that funny how that, you know, in families you can just see surprising resemblances. So what I'd like to do here, I just wanted to say that I'm intertwining in the sessions, and I envision in the book that I'll end up writing, I want to intertwine three stories, my own story and the story of Laura and Lottie 100 years ago, 150 years ago, and the story of what's happening in our country right now. And so you'll see that today, you'll see that, but over the course of the sessions, I'm weaving back and forth between those three stories. And I hope that it ends up then inviting you to do a similar thing, to ask about your own story and the story of your relatives in the past, and how that connects for you and how you think about the U.S. today. So is anyone not from the U.S.? Because it's a particularly U.S.-centric story, and I think there are parallels you could see elsewhere. All right. Let me just see if there are questions or comments or clarifications at this point before I turn the page to thinking about the end of white Christian America. Comments or questions or clarifications? Are you with me? Yes. Anyone else related to Laura Ingalls Wilder? Fit you into the family tree? How many of you have read some or all of the books? Many of you.
Six times.
How many have read them out loud to kids? Many of you. How many of you have been to home sites? Quite a few of you. In 2008, when we moved from the East Coast to Minnesota, we actually spent the summer at Holden before moving into our house. And on the way, driving across the country, we stopped in Pepin. We stopped in Walnut Grove. We stopped in DeSchmidt. In fact, John, who's also on teaching staff this week, was telling me that they went to DeSchmidt and spent the night in a covered wagon and even got a thunderstorm as a part of it.
And actually, we listened to the audio book on the shores of Silver Lake as we drove up there.
This time, since we were driving across South Dakota and we're planning to stop in Keystone, we read By the Shores of Silver Lake out loud as we were driving along through South Dakota. And it's remarkable how the landscape is just so vividly described in the book, especially the big grass sloughs. That's something that features in the book. Well, let me dive into.
I grew up right next to the birthplace of Laura Ingalls Wilder. I was thinking about it the other day. It's really related, but
there's a lot of Holden connections to Pepin.
Yeah. It's just a neat meditative place to like go out and think about that wilderness right here, the first story, but also thinking about some of these questions too. So.
Yeah.
I thought it was interesting too. I think it was maybe a This American Life that did a whole hour-long story about the Dakota-U.S. War that I had never heard about or never was interested in. I
I think it's the one where they were talking about how there was an agreement between the Dakota and the U.S. and how they were, the Dakota were being basically starved out of their food supplies.
Right.
And there was this comment, so they were sort of starving, and there was this backstory to how that erupted into violence and how we kind of don't ever hear that, but they went into great depth. It was really good storytelling about how that kind of came about. And kind of, for me, I haven't really known much about Native American history or indigenous folks, and you know, just hadn't given it much thought, but it was really, really enlightening. So I recommend that, this American Life.
So that's, if you couldn't hear that, there's a hour documentary from This American Life about the Dakota-U.S. war in 1862, which I guess is really well done and helpful. I'm going to, on Friday this week, and then my first session next week, do two sessions that really dig into that. The one on Friday is looking at the ecclesial and legal background of the common sense that you hear in the novels, that white people have a right to land that's wild. That's not, they literally didn't think there were people on the land because they didn't think of Indians as people. And they thought the land could be legally justly claimed by them because they were going to farm and civilize the land. And that sense of justice that they had as a kind of common sense knowledge has a legal and ecclesiastical history that goes back to the 16th century and a couple of papal bulls. And so I want to rehearse that older history as a way to then talk about how that played into the kinds of treaties that were made. And the pressure starving the Indians, withholding the promised allotments of food and money to them, was to push them into making a new treaty. So that, yeah, the more I dig into the history, the more troubling it is to see what in fact transpired. And the really, I mean, and it's not all that the settlers themselves did bad things, but the government, the railroad companies. I mean, there's all kinds of nefarious characters in these stories, and we'll unpack some of that. Yeah.
Are you going to tie it in at all with what happened in Standing Rock this year?
I would say in two ways. When we get to the, when we start talking about the treaties and the reservations and so forth, how that happened, I think it very much connects with Standing Rock and how they ended up, where they ended up, and why, what Standing Rock signifies. I think we went to a, to hear, what was her name?
Phyllis
Johnson? A Lakota elder who was a part of the Standing Rock, the leadership at Standing Rock, talk about what's happening now last week. So yeah, I will later on. Yeah, I think it's important. And the last session is really about where are we going as a country, and I think it's integral to the story of where are we going to ask what place at the table do people have for determining their own future as an equal partner. So this, I have a copy of it. If someone wants to borrow it, I only have one copy. Actually, I have two copies, but one's Isaiah's and my son's, and I won't give his copy away. But you're welcome to borrow my copy while you're here if you want to look at it. But this author, Robert Jones, is a classmate of mine from graduate school, and his specialty is the intersection of religion and politics, and he runs an organization in Washington, D.C. called Public Religion Research Institute, PRRI. And he does polling at the intersection of all kinds of political issues that are hot topics and religious ideas and religious demographics, so he can break down what different religious constituencies think about a whole bunch of issues. And he has what he calls an American Religion Atlas on their website. And so you can look at your state and see how many people support marriage equality, how many people don't, how many people support open access to abortion, how many don't, and even what religious, like what a Hispanic Catholics think versus white Catholics. So he gives lots of really helpful data. And what he realized as he was going along doing this work, he grew up in Jackson, Mississippi, Southern Baptist, very much white Christian America, white evangelical Christian America. And what he realized is that culture that he grew up in, kind of the dominant culture of the United States, white Protestant Christianity, that population was going to hit a point where it became the minority of the U.S. population for the first time in in the country's history. And he was really struck by that, wondering, like, what are the consequences of that? That's a major shift. And not just in that transition, but that transition of the white Christian population becoming a minority sort of is the first step towards white people in general becoming the minority in the country. So he ended up writing this book more or less a year ago, and it came out last summer. And so in the run-up to the fall election, how many people have already read it? Excellent. Well, I'm happy to introduce to you this fantastic book. It became a book that helped people try to make sense of what was happening in the election, especially around overwhelming white support for Trump. Trump pulling together demographic groups that hadn't historically voted Republican. White Catholics, for example, were much more mixed. And so there's a whole sort of story that his book helped to make sense of in terms of what unfolded with the election. And if you get the paperback, he has an addendum. It came out before the election, but the paperback came out after the election, and it has a little addendum where he talks about his understanding of what happened with the election. So what I wanted to do to give you a taste of it is he starts the book with an obituary. So I'm going to read to you the obituary for white Christian America. So if, just get comfortable. I don't know, do you get comfortable when you hear an obituary? No. After a long life spanning nearly 240 years, white Christian America, a prominent cultural force in the nation's history, has died. White Christian America first began to exhibit troubling symptoms in the 1960s when white mainline Protestant denominations began to shrink, but showed signs of rallying with the rise of the Christian right in the 1980s. Following the 2004 presidential election, however, it became clear that white Christian America's powers were failing. Although examiners have not been able to pinpoint the exact time of death, the best evidence suggests that white Christian America finally succumbed in the latter part of the first decade of the 21st century. The cause of death was determined to be a combination of environmental and internal factors. Complications stemming from major demographic changes in the country, along with religious disaffiliation as many of its younger members began to doubt white Christian America's continued relevance in a shifting cultural environment. Many of white Christian America's notable achievements were its service to the nation as a cultural touchstone during most of its life. It provided a shared aesthetic, a historical framework, and a moral vocabulary. White Christian America's vibrancy was historically one of the most prominent features of American public life. While the common culture ground it did offer cultural ground it offered did not prevent vehement or even bloody conflicts from erupting, the lingua franca of white Christian America gave them a coherent frame. As the nation was being born, George Washington invoked white Christian America in his first inaugural address. And when it was being torn apart during the Civil War, white Christian America provided biblical verses and principles that called the nation back to its highest ideals. Without white Christian America, neither Abraham Lincoln's second inaugural address nor Martin Luther King Jr.'s letter from a Birmingham jail could have been written, let alone understood. Virtually every American president has drawn from white Christian America as well, particularly during moments of strife. During its long life, white Christian America produced a dizzying array of institutions, from churches to hospitals, social service organizations, and civic organizations such as the Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, and the YMCA. Beyond these direct functions, white Christian America also helped incubate and promote the missions of countless independent non-governmental organizations that met in its facilities and were staffed with its members. Widespread participation in White Christian America's lay leadership position served as an important source of social capital for the nation, instilling the participants skills they carried not only to other civic organizations, but to democratic governance itself. But White Christian America has not been without its critics and controversies. Its reputation was especially marred by its general accommodation to and participation in the institution of slavery up until the Civil War. In the late 19th and 20th centuries, White Christian America's apathy toward and in some quarters even staunch defense of segregation in the American South did little to overturn these negative associations. Its credibility was also damaged when it became mired in partisan politics in the closing decades of the 20th century. Late in its life, White Christian America also struggled to adequately address issues such as lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender rights, which were of particular importance to its younger members, as well as to younger Americans overall. White Christian America is survived by two principal branches of descendants, a mainline Protestant family residing primarily in the Northeast and Upper Midwest, and an evangelical Protestant family living mostly in the South. Plans for a public memorial service have not been announced. And he points out that there are only six states in the United States right now that have over 50% white Christian population. Only six. There are two in the Midwest, and the rest are in the South and Appalachia. And so there's a kind of south center of the country that's predominantly white Christian, and the West Coast and most of the East Coast are at least below 40%, and in some cases much less. Here's a short video, just a couple minutes, of Robbie presenting some of the key insights of his book, and I thought it would be a change of pace for you to hear from another white Christian man. Let's see if I can do it this way.
The remarkable truth is this. America is no longer a white Christian country, and that's going to have profound implications. In the early 1990s, fewer than 1 in 10 Americans said that they were religiously unaffiliated. That number today is nearly a quarter. It's 23%. About two-thirds of seniors identify as white and Christian. But if we go down to the youngest Americans, those under the age of 30, only 29% of that group identifies as white and Christian. Today we have 0 Protestants on the U.S. Supreme Court, and if Merrick Garland is confirmed, we will have 5 Catholics and 4 Jews. The 2012 election with Romney versus Obama is a good illustration of just how quickly the power of white Christian America has declined. Romney actually did pretty well on white evangelical voters. He hit all the basic marks that his campaign should have hit. If he had run the same campaign he ran and got the same kind of support he got in 2004, he would have won. But what had changed between 2004 and 2012 was that the religious and racial landscape had shifted just enough that it wasn't enough to put him over the top. Now, obviously, we're seeing Donald Trump running with this playbook. We may have a real test case on our hands about whether or not there are, in fact, enough white Christian voters out there for a Republican candidate to win, relying on those supermajorities. One key question is, what does it mean to be an American? What is the image of America that comes to people's minds when they even hear the word America? And I think that's one of the things we're struggling over in the country today. For many white evangelicals, I mean, they see something that looks like a Norman Rockwell painting, a white Protestant family gathered around a Thanksgiving table. And I think for many that evokes this era of the 1950s, where white, conservative Christian values really hold sway. Compare that to the Coca-Cola commercial that aired during the Super Bowl. We had all kinds of families, you know, they were black, they were white, they were Latino, they were Asian, and they were Muslim, and they were Christian. And it set off a firestorm of controversy. You know, many conservative white Christians saying, like, this is not at all the America we ought to be celebrating. In fact, it's a departure from this image that we have. People fight like that when they are losing a sense of place, a sense of belonging, and a sense of the country that they understand and love. So thinking about the descendants of white Christian America that are still here with us today, and again, it's still 45% of the country, it's a lot of people. how do they re-engage in public life when they can't be the majority? On the one hand, there are leaders, I think, such as Russell Moore at the Southern Baptist Convention, who's really trying to take these shifts really seriously and to figure out how to engage in a way where they're taking one seat at the table and not pretending that they own the whole table. On the other hand, I think we're seeing some real reactions against this, and we're seeing it with the evangelical leaders who are really supporting Trump, calling for Christians to kind of turn out and reclaim their dominant space in public life. There just aren't the numbers out there for that to happen. America is no longer a majority white Christian country.
So he does an interesting, and I think somewhat problematic thing, but he defends it by claiming that the historic dominant Christian group in the United States is Protestant. And so he puts together evangelical and mainline Protestants and calls that white Christian America, because that group was the one that was historically dominant and in some cases didn't even view new Catholic immigrants, say from Ireland, as white. They were called niggers. They were considered not white when they first came. So he separates out Catholics from white Christian America, and if you put them together, I don't have a slide for it, but he has a breakdown, and I can quickly tell you what it is. He says, if you take the whole population of white Christians, including Catholics, is 47% of the country. So, and if you just include white Protestant Christians, it's 32%. So he does two things with them. He includes them sometimes, and he separates them other times when he's talking about this historic Protestant sort of WASP, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant dominant form of white Christianity in the U.S. So here's a graph that shows the whole U.S. population projected from 2015 to 2060, and you can see in the big teal bar just this precipitous decline in the percent of the white population, and then growth in the others, especially in the orange, which is Hispanic, and then also in the red, that's Asian, and then interestingly, this growth in the green, which is multiracial people, and so the overall placement of the shift to white minority is more or less in the 2040 to 2050, somewhere in there, according to these projections. And the two driving forces of this are immigration and differential birth rates. That's the main reason why this huge demographic shift is happening. And later in the sessions, when I talk about my childhood, sort of my little house in the suburbs, I titled it, I'm going to talk about the Immigration Act of 1965, which is a watershed moment in the history of the U.S. and has direct implications for what's unfolded here. Yeah.
So in light of that, is immigration different now than it was in your relative's time? Are the causes of people immigrating, the climate change, and war, and habitat loss? Can you make comparisons?
That's interesting. I hadn't thought about it exactly. What do you think? I think there's some similar reasons, looking for a better life, looking for a safe life, away from war. Yeah.
Yeah,
there's a large shift in the legal status of immigration in the United States today. We don't promote immigration. We allow immigration to a certain degree. We don't promote it the way we used to in the past.
Yeah, I mean, one of the interesting things about the expansion of the U.S. territory westward is the boosterism about the availability of land, not just to people back east, but to people in Europe, trying to encourage immigration, trying to encourage population growth and settling the land as it was bought, claimed, stolen, whatever.
However you could sell it.
Yeah. This is a second slide showing the shifting population of people who affiliate religiously. So, it's by age group. So in the top, it's the 18 to 29 year old, 30 to 49 year old, 50 to 64 year old, and 65 plus. And the dark blue line is white Christian. So this is just showing when you move from the white population overall to the white Christian population, one of the reasons for its precipitous decline is the large number of young people. If you look at the orange section on the right, that's the people who, when they're asked what religious affiliation they have, say none. And so you can see how small it is in the 65 plus and how large the white Christian population is. And when you go down to the 18 to 29 demographic nationwide, the green one is non-white Christian. So white Christian, non-white Christian, and then this big 34%, and it's growing every year, of young adults who say, I don't have any religious affiliation. And so that very fact in itself, when you add that to immigration with people from a variety of faith traditions, Christian and otherwise, and differential birth rates, those three factors are what led to the white Christian population becoming a minority in the country much sooner than the overall white population is.
Where do biracial Christians fall in that graph?
I would assume in the non-white Christian. I don't know for a fact what they did with this survey, but that's what I assume with the green. So in Robbie's short presentation, he posed this challenge about how we view this moment. If we think primarily in terms of a story of looking backwards to the 1950s, he calls it a nostalgia perspective, or if we have a future-oriented perspective looking forward to 2050 America. And he asked this question in one of his surveys a year ago just to gauge how people fall in regards to this. And I'm going to ask you first, and then I'll tell you what, in general, Americans' answer to the question. And the question is, has the U.S. gone downhill since the 1950s? Have things gotten, do you think things have gotten mostly worse or mostly better since the 1950s? So how many think mostly worse since the 1950s?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
So about 8. Yeah. But you know what survey questions, they always simplify things to sort of get your gut. And that's what they were doing, to get people's gut feeling. Are things worse now than they were in the 50s or better? How many people think they're better than they were in the 1950s? Yeah, better now than in the 1950s. So,
how many people think they're the same?
So this room was maybe 5-1, things have gotten better rather than worse. The United States as a whole was split more or less. 53% said mostly it's gotten worse, and 46% said mostly it's gotten better. But when you focus in on white evangelicals, almost 3/4 said it's gotten worse since the 1950s. And when you ask Hispanic Catholics, almost two-thirds said it's gotten better since the 1950s. So when you break it down according to demographics, the same thing when you do Republican-Democrat. Republicans much more likely to say it's gotten worse since the 50s. Democrats much more likely to say it's gotten better. So what he ended up...
break it down according to wealth or economy.
Same kind of things. You see more diversity. It's that the nation as a whole comes out kind of close to 50-50, but as soon as you start breaking it down, I don't know what you'd get if you did sort of economic status, but he has that information. I mean, it's one of the lovely things about his publications is they break down all those specific demographics, so you get a sense of how it plays. There's another hand I saw here. All right. So what I'd like you to do is, we have 10 minutes before the end of the session, just spend 5 minutes with a couple people near you, and just tell in your group, your conversation partners, your thoughts about these two questions. Where have you seen the demographic changes of the USA, and how do you feel about these demographic changes? An example might be in our community, what in the Twin Cities, what municipal pamphlets are printed in. They're printed in Spanish and English and in Hmong. Another example might be what languages are spoken in your community or in your elementary school, how many languages are represented. It might be what food you see at the grocery store, or what kinds of different little neighborhood grocery stores do you see. There's lots of ways that it could show up in your community or in your, even in your state, maybe not in your community, but in your state. And many people, and I think this question he asked about, do you feel like things have gotten worse or better since the 1950s, is getting at how people feel about the changes. And so that's why I asked this question to you about how you feel about the changes. So take a few minutes and talk to your neighbors about where you see the changes, if you see them any in any particular ways, and how you feel about them. First of all, on a hot afternoon in a stuffy room, thank you for coming. Secondly, thanks for engaging in robust conversation with your fellow villagers around these questions. It's interesting to consider the range of places people are from and how different those places are in this demographic transition. If you're into this kind of thing, the New York Times did an interactive map that shows by county all across the country how close your county is to the national demographic pattern in 1950 or the projected demographic in 2050. So it's like a past future demographics map that looks at your particular county and says where it is on this shift. Two things I wanted to say to wrap up. One is that it would be, I think, fun to hear just some popcorn feelings, like what, without even explanation, just out of the room, what are some of the feelings that people have about these demographic changes? And I'll just pause and let people popcorn out some word that represents your feeling about the shifts. And obviously it's going to have contextual reasons, but just to hear some of the different words that people would use about this shift.
You were saying in our local group, it's really hard for us to judge people from the Seattle area where the economy is just booming. Mm-hmm. It's hard for us to see, you know, that can't be happening everywhere.
Yeah.
But it certainly colors our view of.
Interesting. So the economic viability of the community affects how people feel about the diversity. Maybe. What are other feelings? Just throw out words.
Exciting.
Yeah.
Exciting.
Challenged.
Challenged.
Relief.
Relief. What else?
Depressed that I'm thinking about everywhere except in the church.
Hmm. Yeah, for those of us who are ELCA Lutherans, we're the whitest denomination in the U.S.
Wow. Why is that?
What any other feeling words people want to share?
It makes me feel innovative, or it makes makes me feel excited about the possibility of just having the box broken open to say, what does it mean to integrate and appreciate these new majorities?
Cool.
I'd be really hopeful as a grandmother, and so many of my friends that are grandmothers, so many of our grandkids are biracial, and just that kind of movement toward maybe mixed society, I think it's hopeful.
Great. Well, and I said Barack Obama was the first African-American president. He was also the first biracial president. Although, maybe that there may have been presidents in the past who had some native, I don't know. But they're all kind of categorized as white men, so. Well, tomorrow I'm going to talk about Little House in the Big Woods and tell some of the backstory on Laura and my great-grandmother, my Lottie, and look at some features of that time, especially the Emancipation Proclamation and the Homestead Act, which happened both the same year, 1862, and what the end of the Civil War set off in terms of almost an explosion of westward movement of the population. So that's what we'll turn to tomorrow. Thank you very much.